Well, welcome to the final show for Things That Matter for this season number two. We have three very special guests today, including the former director of the American Peace Corps, Carrie Hessler-Radley, and two young aspiring leaders, Rose Kamyab and Maymay Weston. Before I get into a more formal intro of our fantastic guests, let me reflect on some of the themes we've touched on in the past seven shows of this season. As promised, I'm going to close the show with an announcement of my decision whether or not to run in the next federal election. But we'll leave that point to last, as I don't want in any way to take away from our discussion of challenges to women in leadership. So let me share screen here for just a sec. You can find our shows on johnweston.ca, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. So that's handy. And if you're inclined to follow what we're doing, we are on four social media platforms. You know them, they're LinkedIn and they're Twitter, and they are Facebook and of course, Instagram. A quick review of our seven shows suggests that there's at least one common theme, and I think you're gonna see that running through our conversation this evening. That is the question of how young people should lead and how they should support good leaders. What is your hope for the future if you are a Gen X or a Gen Z person? Climate change rampaging, a brutal war in Ukraine, tensions in the Taiwan Strait. We've touched on all of these things in our last shows. So what should a good person do who's pursuing virtuous goals in such a complicated world? One CBC guest said last week, something I'll never forget. He said that in past, we were keen to see that our children were going to school. And in America nowadays, we're hoping our kids return from school. So rather a gaunt prospect. And we can, on the one hand, celebrate that BIPOC concerns and gender identity matters are now in the open. And I know that at least some of you in the audience and some of our panelists have been involved in advocating in those areas. But also just consider the levels of complexity those things add to an already complicated world. In this milieu, where do we look for role models? In one of our shows, we talked about heroes and role models. What can motivate young people to pursue really great things, to love their neighbors and inspire to improve their community and their world? Why should we have any confidence that the world will be better tomorrow than it is today? And what do us baby boomers have to contribute to encourage people like Rose and Maymay? If we all agree we want to go from good to great, in the words of one of my favorite authors, what do we have to contribute to support the journey of Generation Z? I'm eager to hear what each of Carrie and Rose and Maymay have to say. Well, our guests have several things in common. Not just are they outstanding people, but there's lots of other things too. They're optimists and they're resilient and they're hardworking and they're accomplished. They have great sets of values. They appreciate the importance of working in teams and they're ready to fight for the things that they believe in. I've known each of our panelists for a long time. Carrie, I met when she was majoring in international relations at Boston University, an academic focus we both share. Inspired by her aunt, Ginny Kirkwood, she learned a love for humanitarian work and caught President Obama's eye and became his appointed head of the U.S. Peace Corps. Imagine leading one of the world's most respected organizations with, I think the number is over 7,000 volunteers sprinkled around the world's hotspots. She has countless stories about advocating for needy people around the world and for standing up for her own volunteers. Today, she continues her passion for humanitarian work as the head of Global Communities, an international nonprofit organization dedicated to saving lives, advancing equity, and securing strong futures. And as we speak, she's risen in the middle of the night because she's in Amman, Georgia, not Georgia, Amman, Jordan, on one of her countless business trips. Rose Kamyab, I met when she was a high school student, a key volunteer member of the Canadian-Iranian Steering Committee, and an invaluable teammate to me as a member of parliament. She consistently surprised the adults around her by her work ethic and her good judgment. She's parlayed her deep compassion for human rights into an aspiring medical career, and she's now a resident at McGill Med School in Montreal. Yay. And she's also a key member of the communications team for the Canadian Health and Fitness Institute. Mamie Weston, I've known well since she was born. And yes, she's been a fairly dominant tail that has often wagged this dog. She graduated from Harvard last month in History of Science and Government. At university, she rowed for the varsity team, served as Prime Minister of the Canadian Club, and was instrumental in using social media to bring down a campus social club guilty of allowing assaults on women. In a page out of your book, Carrie, she's also worked during COVID for a nonprofit organization in Senegal that supports women leaders. So with that, I can't wait. And I don't really know how to start, but I'm going to throw out a question for you to dive in on. Especially for the guys in the audience who may be powerful advocates for women, how do challenges to women in leadership differ from challenges to men? Who wants to go first?
That was a hypothetical question.
This one here, so I'll just dive in. There are still many challenges to women's leadership, mostly due to social and cultural norms. And as I think we're discussing right now, they are changing so rapidly. The norms that Mamie and Rose are going to face as career professionals today are so different from the norms that I faced when I began my career 40 years ago. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, I know. But a few of the differences that come to mind include stereotypes that suggest that women are not as assertive or confident or competent, or perhaps more emotional than men. This is, I think, a persistent problem for women who prefer a more collaborative or soft-spoken approach to leadership. And I have to say that this has been an issue for me, as I have always strived for a more inclusive approach to leadership. And throughout my career, there have been those who thought that I would have trouble making a tough decision. And they have discovered that I don't, but those who are comfortable with a more traditional top-down style may not respect a softer approach. Although I have to say, in my experience, they usually learn to respect it. Another challenge I think that women still face is bias in the workplace, including unequal pay and more limited opportunities for promotion, although that also is changing. And I would also say that because there are relatively fewer women in leadership in some sectors, and that is not the case in my sector, the NGO sector, but in some sectors, and there are fewer mentors, then women may have access to fewer networks in their field. But that is, again, changing. I'll give you a positive example of change. I was the chair of an organization called Interaction, which is the US coalition for all American international organizations. It includes, organizations like CARE, Mercy Corps, World Vision, down to very tiny international nonprofits of maybe a budget of $500,000. So it runs the whole gamut. But it's our trade industry, let's just say. But the women CEOs in that coalition formed their WhatsApp group, a women CEO WhatsApp group. And the men were so jealous about it and saw that there was so much good that was generated from it that they begged to join the women CEO WhatsApp groups, which I thought was terrific. I thought that was fabulous. And then the last thing I would say, and then I'm going to stop, is that women still face challenges in balancing leadership roles with family responsibilities. And one of the articles that I suggested in my pick was a groundbreaking and really highly controversial article by Anne-Marie Slaughter that was written in 2012, but really is still relevant today. And I think that we all saw that workplace inequities were exacerbated by COVID for women, and we're still dealing with the fallout from from COVID. But I would also say that men, especially younger men, are really stepping up to share the burden of family responsibilities. But in general, and particularly in more conservative parts of our countries in North America and beyond, society continues to place a greater burden on women to manage family life as well as work life. And this is a hard one because many women, including myself, really wanted to be the primary caregiver for their families, even as they balance their time with a career. So it can lead to burnout. So let me just stop there.
I'm sitting here thinking, if you're this good at 2:30 in the morning or whatever time it is in Amman, Jordan, imagine how he would be at normal work times.
That was amazing. If I fall asleep, just nudge me. Maybe call me.
And you referred to your pick. So I just want our audience to know, and by the way, welcome audience from around the world. Thank you for joining us. We will be getting to our panelists' picks, which is often a highlight of the show, and you'll see what Carrie is referring to in her article. Rose, Maymay, what are your thoughts?
Rose, would you like to take it away?
Thank you. I appreciate that, Maymay. I think as Carrie mentioned earlier, there's definitely generational differences in the differences between women in leadership today and women in leadership, maybe even in my mom's generation or maybe even in my cousin's generations who are a little bit older than we are. But I think one of the more striking things that affects my generation today in striving for leadership positions, as Carrie also mentioned, is the stereotypes that aren't just about how competent women are, but also about the responsibilities that women have. So no matter what we strive for, there's always a double-edged sword of how to be a woman while being a leader. It's almost as if those two things are oxymorons. As if a woman leader, the world is always trying to prove that those two things cannot exist in the same sentence together. So you're always trying to prove that, you know, you can be feminine, you can still wear makeup, you can wear heels and a skirt and still be a leader. You can raise a family, still have kids, still want to be a supportive spouse or supportive partner and still be a leader. And you know, and if you fail at any one of those things, if you fail as, you know, as a traditional mother, if you fail as a primary health caregiver for your parents, if you fail as a spouse, if you fail as a partner, if you fail at any one of those things, it's like, okay, see, you couldn't be a woman and a leader at the same time. And if you fail at being a leader, then see, you're just a woman, you can't be a leader. So it's almost as if, you know, I find with a lot of my male colleagues, once they make it into that leadership position, the onus on them is to do the job and to do it well. And that's their responsibility. But once you make it as a woman in leadership, you still have to prove every day that you deserve to be there. Every day you have to wake up, you have to prove that you can still be a woman, you can still have the responsibilities that the traditional stereotypical responsibilities that society puts on you, but you can still be a leader at the same time. And that's what I think Carrie was referring to as the burnout that we'll face, because there are just so many different things that we have to tackle every day. And it's those nuances that really burn you out. It's those nuances that you have to prove you can do the job, but it's everything else that comes along with it that you have to prove that you also have to do. That becomes very challenging for women to do. And oftentimes, even if we have those opportunities, even if those leadership positions exist, women tend to apply for them far less than men do. They tend to reach for them less because it's exhausting and it's difficult to juggle with everything, because oftentimes we do have to juggle a lot more. Mm. And that's my perspective on the matter.
So I'm going to characterize Carrie's and Rose's remarks as somewhere between daunting and bleak. and yet part of me, you know, has observed from time to time what a great time to be a woman in North America, maybe in the world. But anyway, I don't want to get in your way, Maymay. What are your thoughts on these things?
Well, first of all, John, I want to thank you for having us as panelists on your show. It's truly an honor to be on this panel beside Carrie and Rose, two amazing women who have inspired me in my life.
Likewise, Maymay.
Thank you, Rose. but John, to your question as to why or what challenges are specific to women in leadership in comparison to men in leadership, I think it's important to acknowledge that being a woman in a male leadership dominated world, we start one step behind in most cases all men, and it's important to note that that's just one layer of discrimination. There's lots of other layers of discrimination out there that myself as a white woman I don't need to deal with, but as a woman I am still one step behind in most cases. And I think that one of the specific examples that women deal with in fighting for leadership positions is dealing with these stereotypes that were mentioned. And I think one of the most prominent ones are balancing the likability of being a woman and not crossing the line of being too aggressive, which many stereotypes come across as an aggressive woman. You know, the first word that comes to mind is the B word that I'm not going to mention on this show, but always striking that balance of being involved, getting your voice heard and respected, but at the same time you can't be too heard because then you're too aggressive as a woman.
That's really intriguing. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think if I pair the words aggressive man and then aggressive woman, I have different sentiments about those things. And I think of an aggressive man and I think of the sports field. And I think, oh, well, the guy is probably, you know, a good athlete. It's interesting. I'm just reflecting on my own thoughts. There is something pejorative about the word aggressive, whether it's a man or woman, but I can see it's more jarring when paired with a woman. So in that context, let me reflect on a previous podcast where we had a fantastic woman role model, Lynn Kanuka, who was a bronze medalist in the Los Angeles Games, came from tremendous adversity, ran against Zola Budd and Mary Decker, famous race. And on that same podcast was Dave Bentall. They talked about heroes and mentors. Given the challenges you've talked about, how do you find a mentor how has a mentor influenced your leadership? Any thoughts about that?
I can go first on this one. I've been thinking about this. I'm currently living with my teammates on the rowing team at Harvard, and I have to say that having competed in competitive sports my whole life, being surrounded by strong women has been incredibly inspiring for me, and I think has given me a toolkit in being a leader in my communities as a woman, despite the step down that I start from. So that all of the women in my life from the sports teams have had an incredible impact on me. One woman that I wanted to mention that I was just talking to earlier today is Patricia Senekye, who was my boss in Senegal. She's overcome so many challenges, and she's done it with love and with grace. And she balances not only founding an organization that coaches women in leadership and organizations in general in leadership and fostering good community within their organizations, she has a family, and she comes home every day, turns off her phone, and spends quality time with her family, which I think is incredible, because it's really hard to do that these days, especially as someone with so much responsibility. And I think what really struck me was when she told me that Senegal is facing many challenges right now, lots of violence and protests, and specifically in Dakar. And she said something along the lines of, I try to lead my life with love. It's really hard in the face of fear, but people like you and other strong women and mentors in my life give me the strength to choose the path of love and not fear. So I want to lead my life with love and surround myself with women and other mentors, male and, you know, non-women or male mentors in my life who can lead me and show me how to lead my life with love.
Well, I might be on thin ice in uttering a gender biased comment in this company, but I'm going to do it anyway. Having observed the women on Meme's crew team, I cannot think of a finer, grittier group of people if I had to choose a campaign team or a business team and I got a bunch of Maymay's teammates together, man, I tell you, we would rock. So there's something about the sport world that brings out a great combination in women. I think it's that camaraderie and that grit, which is a powerful combination. All right. Who wants to go next?
I can go next because I think my answer is in a little bit opposite to Maymay's, in that I've also had incredible mentors in my life, but just given the environment that I've put myself in and the careers that I've worked in, most of them have been male dominated careers. So I think actually my mentors have all been male. One of them is John Weston on the show right now. And and I think the most important part growing up in my life was I come from a family of very strong women. Of, you know, my grandmother, she is someone that I always looked up to and who, you know, was never really given opportunities, but she made the best of every situation and she did it with a smile on her face. You know, she worked the job of a diplomat without ever actually being given the salary or the position of a diplomat. She really united her neighbors. She lived in a neighborhood in Iran where all of her neighbors were Jewish people, Christians, and Muslims. And somehow she created, you know, she made world peace in that little community in her little town. And I think one thing that I always looked up to her for was the way that she helped other women without needing recognition, without wanting to help other people, without needing recognition or without wanting to advertise that she's helping other people. And what she did was just through the basement of her own house with you know, the income that she had worked for, that she had, she would harbor women who were either in abusive relationships or women who wanted to get education who wanted to leave homes that weren't the best for them. And she would help them and support them and help them stand on their own feet and get the education that they wanted. And she did this without telling anyone. I would just see it because I was, you know, I would just follow her around and I was a little kid and I would realize what she was doing. And so to me, it was never an issue whether women are competent or women can accomplish tasks. And I never needed those female role models because I had them all my life. But I think the number one adversity that a lot of the women of the older generations faced was the lack of opportunities to be recognized for their leadership and to be given positions to actually perform that leadership on a larger scale. And I think one thing that I'm extremely grateful for is from a very, very young age, I had mentors in my life who gave me the opportunities to show that. And one of them was John Weston. You know, I walked into his office with all the audacity and gumption at 15 years old and told him, so you're the member of parliament in this area. I want to be involved and I want to make decisions about my community and about the people and about foreign affairs. And I think you need to invite me I think you need to let me help. And, you know, he could have kicked me out of his office. Frankly, thank you so much as a constituent for coming to my office. You know, once you're grown, come back and we'll have a discussion. You know, that's easily what he could have told me. But, you know, he asked me for my email. He gave me his, told me to email him and told me to show up. He's like, you know what, if you think you can do this, you can show up to a round table where a steering committee discusses foreign affairs and community affairs, and you can join us and see, we'll see what you have to say. And if the team likes you, then you can stay on. And he never once doubted my ability to do anything. He never, just based on the stereotypes of whether I was a woman, whether I was young, whatever the stereotypes surrounding women in leaderships are, he just gave me opportunities without second guessing me. And I really think that experience itself really shaped me. It gave me the confidence to walk into offices and ask for things and to want to be in leadership positions and to really believe that I had something valuable to offer. And another mentor that did the same for me in the academic setting, less than political setting, was Dr. Neil Cashman, who, again, I walked, because of the experience that I had with John, I walked into his office and I walked into his lab and said, listen, I think I really like Alzheimer's research and I really want to be involved in medicine. I'm not sure exactly in what capacity, but I would love it if you'd let me do research with you. And again, without questioning me, without saying, you know, you're just the first year undergraduate student or you are this or you're that, or applying stereotypes to me, he gave me the opportunity. And I think that's what I'm really grateful for for the mentors around me is the fact that they gave me those opportunities to prove myself. And they didn't apply those stereotypes to me. And I hope that's the kind of mentor that I get to become for other people someday.
Rose, what was the example we were speaking about the other day where the woman, she created the invention, but the man got all of the respect and—
Watson and Crick in the DNA, the discovery of the DNA double helix. It was a PhD student, I think, who was a female who actually discovered the DNA double helix. But even to this day, even though we know, the reason that we know is I personally know it from Instagram posts where they've said, actually, Watson and Crick did not discover the DNA double helix. It was a PhD student. And she was, I think she was, if I'm not mistaken, I think she was a woman of color and she discovered, but in our textbook to this day, the name that I still even remember is Watson and Crick.
Watson and Crick.
So
I'm going to jump in here because I find what you just said to be really intriguing and points to an omission in my introduction. I commented on common characteristics among the three of you, and one of them I missed is humility. And I think this is something I've seen you, Carrie, walk the talk of all your life. I mean, no one would know that you led one of the most revered organizations in the world by the way you carry yourself. You're there to help, to, you know, put your shoulder into things. Let me stop there. I'm keen to hear what you have to say about mentors, because you're a mentor to many, but who are the mentors and the heroes that you have been influenced by?
And a mentor to us, to me.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Maybe, you know, I want to start by saying how blown away I am by these young women. I mean, the world is in such great shape with you in charge. I mean, it's just, it's so wonderful to be part of this conversation. And my heart is soaring as a woman to know that the next generations are so just phenomenal and motivated and powerful. So
Carrie, I don't think you understand how nerve-wracking and absolutely an honor it is to be on the same call as you and to be just the same thing as you. Like, who am I?
We can all agree on that.
Taking deep breaths.
And we're both talking the same about way. The same thing as if we're on the same level, and it blows my mind.
Yeah, we are, and that's what's so fabulous. I mean, I just want to say that, and I also want to say one other thing to Mamie, and that is I'm so grateful that you introduced, you know, your first comment with the understanding that we carry great privilege. Those of us who are on this podcast today, we live lives of great privilege, and we need to understand that. And I'm so glad that you brought that in. So I just want to start with that. My mentor actually is more like Meme's mentor. My mentor was a midwife whose name I have actually forgotten, but she was a person who changed my life profoundly. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I think John alluded to that in his introduction. My husband, Steve, and I served as Peace Corps volunteers in Samoa in the early 80s, right after college. And every Peace Corps volunteer is given a host family, and my host family was Losa and Vianney. And Losa was 32 at the time. I was 24. She already had 8 children, and her reproductive life had begun at age 14. And I came home from school one day about 6 months after I'd been there, and she was weeping so hard. I've never witnessed such grief in all my life. And I thought that one of her children had died, or maybe her husband, or something terrible had happened. But the reason for her tears was that she had just found out that she was pregnant again with her 9th child. And she did not know how she was going to manage her pregnancy with, you know, 8 other children. They were subsistence farmers. She was exhausted and did not know how she was going to manage it. And I knew nothing. I was 24. And I said to her, I mean, I knew nothing about pregnancy is what I really meant. And so I asked her questions. I said, well, where do you go for help? You know, do you have a healthcare provider? And she said, no, I deliver my babies here on the floor with my mother-in-law. Every single one of my babies has been delivered right here on this floor. And I was worried about it, because although I knew nothing about pregnancy, I knew that her youngest child was only 14 months old and she had had a lot of children in rapid succession. And as a Peace Corps volunteer, we had to map the village when we arrived. And so I knew that there was a midwife, a trained midwife, very close, less than a mile on a paved road. So I asked Losa if she would come with me to the midwife. And she had never been to a midwife for her own care. And so we went to the midwife, and the midwife told Losa, you have very severe anemia. You're going to have to take iron tablets. You're going to have to come here every month, and you're going to have to deliver your baby here in this facility because you are a high-risk pregnancy. And she was crestfallen because she knew that her husband, Vianney, would allow her to take the tablets and would allow her to come to the clinic once a month because it was free. But she knew that she would never be able to deliver her baby with the trained provider because Samoan babies are born at home. That is the way it was. And this midwife was very worried about Losa, I could tell. But what the midwife did is she started coming. We went back, and Vianney, sure enough, said, no, there's no way you can deliver your baby in the health facility. And Losa had no decision-making power whatsoever in this decision. It was entirely the decision to be made by her husband. And so the midwife started accompanying us every single month back to the house. She scheduled Losa for the end of the day, and she walked back with us every month, and she would sit and have tea with us, and we'd talk, and we'd talk about the weather, we'd talk about rugby or soccer, we'd talk about church, or we'd talk about the community, we'd talk about anything except healthcare, until about 6 or 7 months later, when eventually, after building a strong relationship of trust with the family, she started talking about how important it was for Losa to deliver her baby in the health facility. And she listened to their concerns about wanting to have the baby's first encounter with a human being to be the one who is the person who loves them, the family member. They want, you know, the first face that a child should see is their family, not the midwife. And so when it came time for Losa to deliver her baby, Vianney and more importantly, the mother-in-law, whose name was Margarita, had agreed, because of their trust in this amazing midwife, they would in fact deliver their baby in the health facility. And the midwife permitted Margarita to be the one who delivered the baby, but she was there on standby in case any help was needed. And so the baby was born. Little baby Margarita, actually they named it after the mother-in-law, Vianney's mother-in-law, was born without a problem. But 5 minutes later, Losa went into postpartum hemorrhage, and she would have bled to death on the floor of her house. But because she was in a health facility where they had blood supply, they had medicine, oxytocin, and they also had an ambulance service. So they were able to transport Losa to a hospital, and her life was saved. That baby Margarita became one of the first women lawyers in Samoa, and she leads a family law practice. But that midwife's wisdom in understanding the cultural norms and working with the family and guiding the family to the right decision in a very quiet way, with love and grace, to use a word that Meme used about Patricia, was such an inspiration for me as a young woman. And I think of that midwife, and I feel so sad that I don't remember her name, but she was truly a mentor to me, and I have modeled my life after hers.
That is a great story. And I find it intriguing. You actually cut your teeth in humanitarian work in maternal and childhood health, right? Isn't that mm-hmm. really what you were doing in Samoa?
Yeah, I'm a public health professional. That is what I did for most of my career.
Yeah. Wow. What an incredible story. And there's some fantastic women in the audience today. I just want to call out Patricia. Thank you for joining us from Senegal, and Susie Winthrop coming in from Massachusetts. It's really amazing that you're here, incredible women leaders in your own right. Well, I'm a proponent of a peculiar philosophy. I think that success creates really good people, and I think adversity creates really great people. So I'm going to ask you to ponder some moment in your life where it was really difficult to be a leader. Maybe it wasn't even successful. Maybe in the short term, you think it didn't work out well. And my favorite advice from my accountant who's been with our family for decades from my parents' time is, John, in life, sometimes things don't work out. And I said, we pay you a lot for that advice. Anyway, what are some examples where it's been hard to be a leader or where you feel you've stumbled? Any thoughts about that? That's a hard one. You can duck if you want.
Well, I'm happy just to get things started actually on that. I would say historically, the issue I'm best known for publicly and have spent most time on as a leader is the prevention of sexual exploitation, assault, and harassment in the workplace, which started with the Peace Corps very, very early in my tenure there. Actually, 2 weeks after I arrived, we got a call from the television program 2020 because they had numerous complaints. They were following up complaints by Peace Corps volunteers who had been sexually assaulted as volunteers, and the agency had not handled their cases well at all. And then even more painful than that was the story of the Pusey family who lost their beautiful, incredible, courageous daughter, Kate, who was a whistleblower who had been tragically murdered in Benin after reporting the sexual misconduct of a part-time Peace Corps staff person. So I was part of that, the response to this. I actually had to go onto the television program and be the representative of the agency, where I was confronted by these just heartbreaking, deeply personal, and incredibly courageous stories that were shared with me on national television.
And with without a ton of media training at the time,
I had zero media training. I was so unprepared for this. But I have to say, and it was such a powerful experience because it I had myself been sexually assaulted as a Peace Corps volunteer, a fact that I had kept hidden for 35 years. I had not spoken of it to anyone except my husband. My mother didn't know, my children didn't know, my fellow Peace Corps volunteers didn't know. Nobody knows. And I knew that I could not lead with authenticity if I did not come out publicly to divulge my own sexual assault and use my personal experience to bring change, which was a very, very, very painful decision. And so I had to come public with that. And then I had to act. And we made a lot of change. And the change was well documented. In fact, it became the catalyst for a whole reform effort that it was the largest reform effort that the agency had ever undertaken, but it was really dedicated to placing volunteer care support at the forefront of everything it does. I will say that my own status as a survivor allowed me to have conversations with people with a great deal more empathy and credibility almost. I mean, I understood the pain because I actually had to go through that pain once again when I openly acknowledged it publicly. And that experience was very raw, but it also gave me, I think, what I needed to be able to make change in a powerful way. It made me angry and it made me incredibly dedicated to make change. And I've continued now. It's so funny because I'd never thought that this would define my life. But now that I got to the NGO space, I have also, I led a similar initiative as part of my leadership at Interaction, where we developed a global compact that is designed to prevent sexual exploitation, assault, and harassment of and by NGO workers. That led to a set of organizational standards and staff training around this topic by more than 150 international NGOs, following, all the scandals, with Oxfam and Save the Children and many other international organizations where, employees were actually exploiters, perpetrators. It was also at the moment of Me Too. And so, this was a powerful time in history. So for me, it was a deeply personal journey of pain, but also joy as I connected with people, such incredibly strong, courageous women and men, by the way, because men are also sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. So that's my journey, but it was a journey that I think allowed me to be a more compassionate, empathetic leader. So
I can't imagine anybody's heart not being stirred by your account, but I know there's some people in the audience tonight who are especially stirred: Randine Hardy, Kathy Peters, Dorothea Ray. Kathy and Randine have been very involved in fighting against human trafficking in Canada, and Dorothea helped inspire them on their journey, by a book by Nicholas Kristof, you probably know, called Half the Sky, what was a big inspiration for them. So I love it that there's a guy like Nicholas, who with his wife, Cheryl Wu, who's done a lot to fight for women's rights and against human trafficking and sexual assaults. But thank you for that.
And Mamie has done this too. And Rose is, I bet Rose has done something related to this as well. I mean, this is in some ways a topic of our time, but it's the young, I have to say, it's the young women who are standing up and saying no more, no more.
Absolutely.
And so grateful to this younger generation that had the courage that I didn't have. I mean, there was no infrastructure to support my coming forward, but silence is death, in all honesty. And your willingness to speak up makes all the difference.
And I think for us in our generation, we feel that support more from communities and from society. So for you to use your experience and to come forward, that was very brave of you. And I personally really appreciate you sharing that with us tonight. Carrie, thank you.
Yes, Carrie, I want to thank you. And I want to also say that we cannot stand up if we don't have support from people like you. So
exactly.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Sure. How have you struggled, though, in leadership?
I can take that off, Maymay, and I can try to tackle that one. I think for me, very early in my, before I was a medical student, before I was even sure that this is kind of what I wanted to do, I knew that the main thing that I wanted to do was to be involved in human rights. I always, for me, it's, if I'm going to spend the majority of my life, you know, at least 9 to 5 every day, in the best years of my life doing something, I wanted to be, to make sure that, you know, I love that I get to wake up every day, open my eyes, see the sunshine, just the little pleasures of life. So I just wanted to make sure that I dedicate my life to ensuring other people have that privilege and other people can wake up and enjoy those little privileges without the burden of inequality and everything else that often plagues our world today. And I couldn't really decide. I think I had decided, you know, meeting John and having him be my mentor and all the work that we did together, I had really wanted to be involved in politics. And I thought, you know, the best way to go at this would be with through law. And I had joined a lot of, you know, student initiatives and had a lot of different organizations that I worked with that had a lot of government lobbying involved. And there was this one particular campaign that I was very excited about. I was very sure that we were going to do some amazing work. And we had a lot of meetings with different government officials in the works. And most of that had to do with both climate change. It had to do with sexual assault in the workplace. At the time I was at UBC and we had an unidentified person who was sexually assaulting a lot of the students on campus. And so we were doing a lot of work surrounding that. And I think it was the first time in my life that I really felt very small, because, you know, we had gone through, it was a lot of us, we had gotten grants, we'd put together this entire group of amazing students, and we had a plan, we had, you know, we had a lot of infrastructure, and a lot of people didn't show up. And then the ones that did either didn't listen to us or were very dismissive, or we had even one event with media presence. And it ended up being, you know, 45 minutes of introductions of government officials and maybe about 20 minutes of discussions about the issues that we wanted to talk about. And most of that ended up being dismissed as, you know, oh, we'll see what we can do about it. Maybe we can argue it on the parliament floor. And I think it was then that it really changed my trajectory. I decided to take medicine more seriously. I decided to do more research in healthcare and I changed my path. I moved to Toronto. I sort of instigated my career to end up in medical school today. But I think that was the first time that I realized that I need to be somebody, unfortunately, to be taken seriously. And unfortunately, just a student, a female student from UBC was not good enough. I had to know something. And for me, one of the things that I was always very passionate about was healthcare, because I really think that health is one of the most important things that we could have. There's, you know, you can enjoy nothing if you don't have your health. You can't, if you're in pain, if you don't have the full capacities of your body, you can't wake up and enjoy sunshine the way that a healthy person does. So I thought, you know, if I knew enough about medicine, if I knew enough about how to treat the diseases that enter the human body, maybe then that day when I show up to parliament, maybe when I run for office, or when I work with these government officials, I'll have something more meaningful to bring to the table. And those meetings won't feel like such a failure to me. And so far that's exactly what actually has been happening. I had a meeting with a member of parliament last week that because of my experience in medicine, and because of everything that I've learned in the past 2 years as a medical student, I was able to have a much more meaningful conversation with this member of parliament. So I guess we learn from our failures, and that's why it's very important to fail. And I think as women, we are often taught to be perfect. And if you're not perfect, there's something wrong, and you have to look perfect, you have to act perfect, and you have to be perfect, and you have to be just the right amount of everything. And I think that's a huge myth, because without the imperfections, without failing, without all of those experiences, we won't really learn to make the differences that we want to make.
Rose, you touch on a really wonderful topic. I think we needed a whole series on this, to run or not to run, right? And, and you know, I mean, I think I've answered that in various ways in my life. But I can also see that a person can be way more effective by being a healer, for instance. Or, you know, I'm thinking of one person in our audience whom you would all love, Anita Zhang, who is in Taiwan. And Anita has worked for a Taiwan legislator. She cares a lot about freedom and peace in the Taiwan Straits. And she is toying with these questions too. Do I run? Do I get formally involved? Do I need the title, or do I just go and get the job done? Yeah. Maymay, what do you think?
Well, I wish I could see the audience list, because it sounds like an amazing audience list of people from around the world.
It's true.
I one thing that I was thinking about as Carrie and Rose were telling their stories was, Carrie, as you were speaking about this midwife who changed your life, I was thinking, Rose, that could be you someday.
Exactly.
One story that I was thinking about for myself was, I think I was 14 when myself and my whole family, we moved to Taichung for 3 months to study at Donghai Dashui, Donghai Elementary School. On the form, when you sign up to join the school, you check the boxes of the extracurriculars that you want to join. And I'd always played soccer, so of course I checked the box of soccer. And I remember, even before joining soccer, I saw my brothers join the social groups in the classroom and the communities during recess so much more smoothly than I felt like I did. I felt a little more isolated, and my brother was in his Justin Bieber phase, so the girls were just fawning over him, and his hair. One girl actually came up and asked for his autograph, as if he was truly, she knew that he wasn't Justin Bieber, but I remember a vast difference between my own ability to transition into the social groups in comparison to my brothers, and I distinctly think that was the difference between our genders, because I don't find myself as a very awkward human being, but in specific, I remember checking the soccer box, going back to this, and showing up for practice on the first day in a field of men. all boys. I walked away because I didn't think I was in the right place. And this is the same, I've felt the same, I've encountered the same problem in Canada and the US as well. This is just one example, but the boys, being the only girl, was not only isolating because I was the only girl, but the boys would not ever, they were embarrassed to look at me, to speak to me, and even worse, on the soccer field, to pass me the ball. So the only way that I could get the ball was to tackle the other boys. So it took the whole 3 months. I think the only reason that I stayed in the program was because my family was there to emotionally support me when I got back from practice every day. But I remember tackling the ball day in and day out. And finally, that was the only point where they could see that I could actually be on the field the same as them and dribble the ball, shoot the ball, pass the ball, make plays. And eventually I was scoring, and the boys would get all rowdy if I ever either scored or tackled the ball. And by the end of the 3 months, most of the boys ended up like praising me, and some of them had crushes on me. And so my standing on the team had gone from a total disgrace to someone who is worthy and respectable. And it was definitely not an easy transition, but it was a huge life lesson for me. And I'm really fortunate to have my family who supported me through that. And I know, you know, I was 14 years old, but it really felt like a monumental point in my life.
And I think maybe what the experience that you're talking about is something that actually is very important, because I don't think any leadership position is easy for women. And I think that's exactly the point that you just iterated is, you know, probably, I'm guessing it was Shane that walked in and was said to be Justin Bieber.
Yes, it was.
For him, so for him, it's, you know, you, a lot of my, and I see that with my colleagues every day. A lot of my male colleagues walk into a room and they have the confidence and they're just given that respect on a silver platter. And I think that's exactly the example that you use is, you know, in any position of leadership, you don't just walk in and are given respect. You walk in and you work for months, and you then are given the respect if you do a good job. And I think that was your first experience sort of having a taste of that.
Yeah, that's such a great observation, Rose. And, you know, I just think it speaks to your tenacity and perseverance. We have to work twice as hard.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so true. And I can think of other cases after that. So guess who became one of Ontario's top soccer players for her age and then went on in China to spend a week with pre-Olympian Chinese soccer players. Again, it was hard for Mei Mei because she was, again, the other. And at first, I don't want to tell your story, Mei Mei, but you know, she had to overcome being on the outside. And then by the end, she had won her spurs. And by the way, I'm glad you used some good Mandarin, because there's several Mandarin speakers in the audience tonight.
Good. My four words came through. I'm glad I practiced them.
I know Amber Zhao will be happy. And we have in Toronto, Alexei Mojico, who, like you, spent a lot of time in China learning Mandarin, or Taiwan in your case. So anyway, great stories. I have to give my wife some credit too. You know, Donna was instrumental in making that happen. So I don't know how this works into your stories, but it took a lot of vision and effort. I was a small part of it. Donna was a big part of it, making sure that the three then children, you and your two brothers, could go and live in another culture, in another language, in another environment, and have that experience. So,
And talk about towing the line between being a fierce woman who is very liked. I think Donna is the perfect example of that. She, from every single race that I have competed in, that woman chases me down, screaming at me until I pick up the pace. And then on the other side of the line is giving hugs to everyone, and everyone loves her. So, talk about being a fierce and loving woman.
I love
Yeah.
those two adjectives together.
Well, Rose, you touched on this topic that is really near and dear to my heart, and it's intriguing to me that you were considering law and then maybe politics. You've said, okay, medicine, and who knows what after that? Maybe medicine and medicine, right? But let me throw out something that I've been struggling with really all my conscious life. I would say that the world is weighed down by cynicism towards politicians, leaders, and government, whether male or female, really. And it seems you're stuck with two stark choices. You sort of jump into this cynical cesspool with the rest, or you stay away from it completely and say, I'm not going near that because people spend 80% of the time introducing the politicians and 20% of the time doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, so do you jump in, or do you stay out? What's your advice?
You know, John, I think that's a century old question, but I think the best answer to that question that I have, and from just my experience seeing the state of our medical system and speaking with members of parliament in the past couple of weeks about the changes that we need to make in order to have a functioning system in 10 years, is that it's very easy to judge a person by the way that they're doing their job from afar when you don't know what their job entails. And I think that's something that we tend to do with doctors, with politicians, you know. And I think we, especially with doctors and politicians, do it to each other. You know, the doctors are annoyed on the one hand because, you know, the politicians aren't funding healthcare, that they're telling us how to do our job, and you know, they're blaming us for the failings of the healthcare system, where it's because they're not funding it that everything's failing. And I think on the other hand, you know, the politicians are then saying, you know, when it comes near to elections and they don't necessarily have the budget, it's like it's, you know, that suddenly the doctors with the malpractice suits make the news. And so I think it's really important for all of us, for every Canadian doing whatever job that we've chosen to do, to understand the basics of how we all work together and how we function as a society together. And I think by knowing that, that's one of the very constructive conversations that I had with a member of parliament last week, was that, you know, we get as medical students, we get training in how to, one of the issues that he was working on was trans health. And he said, well, you know, there are these doctors that for example won't prescribe this to you, and it would make things so much easier, et cetera, et cetera. And my answer for him was, I am receiving a training that's not just about science. I'm receiving a training that has to do with how to speak with patients, how to understand the diversities of the patients that come through the door, how to respect different cultures, how to respect differences in biology, et cetera, and so on and so forth. And then he explained to me the barriers in his job with respect to what he needs from me and what he needs from the medical system in order to sort of work together and make a difference. So I think it's easy to be cynical about everything, especially in the world, in a world where our, you know, we have a growing population and not necessarily the infrastructure to have all the needs of everyone met. But the most important thing is to work together and to understand where we can all trust each other and where to draw the line of what's my job and what's your job. And conversation, communication. You know, I was having a conversation with my friends the other day, and he told me, I truly think that there's not a single thing in the world that can't be solved by just effective communication, by sitting down and having a proper conversation about what needs to be done. And I think that's why I will never move fully away from politics, because at the end of the day, that's where the policies are made. That's where the allocation of budgets are going to. And it's easy to sit down as a doctor and work in a system that's very difficult and say, see, it's the system that's broken, it's not me. But at the end of the day, then you are an intelligent person who, you know, went through 15 years minimum of school. You can sit down and have an intelligent conversation with a politician or become the politician to make the changes necessary to make the system function. So I think it's a balance of both. It's important to be critical of one another, to hold each other to high standards, but it's also important to have those constructive communication pathways to make the changes that we need to make so that it's not all just cynicism.
So you and Maymay have both from very young ages educated yourselves about the good, the bad, and the ugly about politicians and informed yourselves. And meanwhile, you want to get things done in life and you're constantly going to be going back and forth, I think. Maymay, exactly. Let's go to you and then we're going to see what Carrie has to say, who's lived in Washington, D.C. or its environs for so many years of her life. Maymay, how about you first on this one?
Absolutely. So I'm going to be short. I would say in a world that it has unending problems, and as Taylor Swift would say, full of haters, I would say surround yourself with energy givers and cut out the people in your life who are energy takers.
That sounds like something that Confucius might have said. Love it. Okay.
Yeah, great advice, actually. You know, I live in Washington, D.C., which, you know, talk about cesspool. We're not going to go there. But I mean, but a place where politicians can agree to work together for greater good. I honestly think that the only thing to do is to step up and lead where you can. John, and you have never shied away from that. One of my favorite quotes is by Martin Luther King. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort or convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy. I think that challenge and controversy are exactly the places where we are needed most. And if we are people who care about our world, care about our children, care about others, I feel like there's no other way but to go forward and do what you can to make the world a better place in whatever way path you can. I mean, it doesn't always have to be in running for political office. It could be by helping your neighbor. There are opportunities to serve everywhere, but do something to help someone else. That is, in my mind, the very foundation of being a human being.
I agree.
Very well said. It doesn't have to be in running for political office. So where were you in 2005? Okay, so we're now at a point of the show which I really love, where we get to hear from each of you things that will help our audience members telescope. So they would like to have a lot more of you in terms of your time and your wisdom, but you've given us some thoughts about your special resources that you would like to see. And let's hope that I can bring up your picks. Our tradition is they can be poems, they can be paintings, films, books, something that inspires the audience in some of the things we've been talking about. So Rose, what are your panelist picks?
So my panelist picks are a podcast that I really enjoyed listening to. It's called Hidden Brain by NPR. And I think I love that one. It's so good. It's the best. It takes really big topics and it sort of makes it into digestible chunks for the everyday person to apply to their life. And my favorite episode is an episode called A Better Way to Worry. And it features a female psychologist, Tracy Dennis Tiwari. And she basically discusses how to embrace your worry and how to embrace your anxiousness. And I think it sort of put a lot of that into perspective for me. And a book that I love, that I think is a very worthy read for everybody, is Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez. And that's a very good book. It sort of discusses basically the adverse effects of gender bias on women and how women live in a world that's been designed not necessarily for career success and for success in a way that that is modern and the way that we would like these days. And my third pick is, I love art. I paint often and I love creating things. And an artist that I think was very inspirational was Augusta Savage. who was an American artist. She was a sculptor and an activist. And her story, her work is extremely inspiring because she's the definition of, you know, I always think that in order to, you know, be someone who isn't, you know, as especially as women, I find we tend to be mediators. We tend to want to please as many people as possible in order to keep everybody happy, which is a skill. It's a good thing because we're always attuned to the needs of others around us. But at the same time, it can be difficult to get lost in the needs of others. And so I love it when I see that, you know, there are some women are so laser focused on who they want to be and what they want to accomplish. And as good as we are in seeing the needs of others, they still stay focused on their purpose. And she used a lot of her art to basically to show a lot of figures in the Black communities in the United States and to bring attention to them. And she got a lot of pushback because she was an artist of color. And then through her art, she finally got herself a position in a prestigious university to study art. So those are my picks.
Thank you. Fantastic.
Beautiful. Fabulous.
I'm writing notes as we speak. So. So my first pick is a book called Educated by Tara Westover. It's about this. It's a well-known one. It's about this woman who lives in a very toxic and oppressive culture at home and overcomes every single challenge that you could possibly think of to escape that culture at home, and goes on to do amazing things in her life. She gets several PhDs at Harvard and other schools that I can't name. She from no education completely educates herself and does amazing things. A TV show on Netflix that I really like is Madame Secretary. So it's about this woman who is chosen by the president to be the Secretary of the United States, and she exhibits some characteristics that we've talked about in this podcast of grace and fierceness and just so much wisdom. So honestly, a very inspiring show. A movie is Mulan. So Mulan, as most people know, is about this woman who disguises herself as a guy at first to participate in combat, which is her dream, and to protect her family. And essentially it lives with all these men and does all these extra things to become stronger and wittier than all the other men who don't try as hard as her, which is what we've also talked about in this podcast, about how women have to just do so much more to get to either the same place or above men in most circumstances. And then I have to say the Michelle Obama podcast on Spotify, because Michelle Obama is such an inspirational, amazing woman who's been an inspiration in my life as I've grown up.
Fabulous. Well, Carrie, you gave us a good list, and we're going to publish that
list.
but I'm going to suggest you pick three of your favorites, and we'll publish all of them on our website and get them out to our audience. But what are the ones
you... Mamie and Rose's picks. I think I got a little too cerebral. I did reference the Anne Marie Slaughter article was published in 2012, a long time ago. It was hugely controversial because it was called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. And it was based on her own personal experience in a very high position in the State Department, and how hard it was for her when she had a teenage son back in Princeton, where she had to commute and some people felt that it was sort of a cop out, but I think what her real point was, and Anne Marie is an extraordinary leader, is that we need to create the infrastructure to support women in leadership roles, and that we can't forget that women also have families, just as men can't and shouldn't forget that they are equal partners in this family situation. And she had an incredibly helpful husband, and yet she felt deeply the tug of her family, which as a mother, I feel too. I mean, that has been my life as well. So I really appreciated her honesty, because it was written at a time when most women felt a lot of pressure to say, yes, I can do it all. And she said, I can't. And her honesty took incredible courage. So I appreciate that article so much. Another article I like was by the American Psychological Association. It's a brand new article written in March of 2023 called Women Leaders Make Work Better. And it talks about just how the characteristics and traits that women bring to the workplace. And we talked about some of them: kindness, grace, listening, an inclusive approach. Actually make the whole workplace better, not just for them, but for everybody, including men. So those are two articles that I really like. I'm going to go to a painting. I really like the painting Portrait of Madeleine by Marie-Guillemin Benoist. And I don't know, I'm probably killing the name because I don't speak French, unlike all of you. I apologize for my butchering of your language. But anyway, that was published a century ago. It was just a beautiful picture of a Black woman, like a regular woman, not in a servitude role, but as a beautiful woman. And again, it was hugely controversial when it was put up at the Louvre, but it just demonstrated the beauty of a woman, beauty and strength, inner strength and fierce courage of this woman who she calls Madeleine. I don't even know if that was her name. But I love that painting. I've always loved that painting. And then I guess a book that has been important in my life was The Color Purple by Alice Walker, written several decades ago, but really pivotal, I think, in helping to shape both the women's movement and the civil rights movement.
Wow, fantastic. Well, I'm going to go to one that might surprise you. There is a famous pollster, George Gallup, and he said that this book is the most distributed and least read in Western society. And it's actually not just a book, it's a library and it's a window. And the book has great women role models in it, notably two Jewish women that I can think of that I really admire, Esther and Ruth. And the book is the one that I would take with me if I was stuck on a desert island and had nothing else with me. It would be the Bible. And I find that people don't talk about the Bible these days as what it is. It's a mixture of narrative, it's a mixture of poetry and of discourses. And no matter what your faith, it's full of intriguing, challenging people and experiences. So that would be my pick. And if I had to choose the women in the Bible that I find most intriguing, it would be Ruth and Esther. Esther famously, well, maybe you know the story, because Esther is a Persian queen, and she is confronted with, she's also Jewish, and she's got this very difficult role. She's told if she doesn't appeal to the king, her husband, to spare her people, they will all be slaughtered. And she says, I don't want to do this, because if I do this, I'm sticking my neck out, I'm going to, put my position in jeopardy. And then her mentor, her guide, a guy named Mordecai, says to her, well, maybe if you don't do it, someone else will do it. But on the other hand, maybe you were brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. And those words, maybe you were brought to the kingdom for such a time as this, are sort of those haunting words that have always bugged me. Like, oh man, maybe I have to do this because I'm supposed to. But anyway, that's my pick.
That gets back to your question about cynicism or action. So maybe are you doing a big reveal, John?
Yeah, well, I decided, since this is the season finale and we have these fantastic panelists, and you've been sort of dancing around this question, and your throwaway comment, Carrie, was it doesn't have to be necessary to run for political office. Well, a lot of people have been very kind and encouraged me to run again, and I would love to. And there's so much good about running for office, and you meet people like Rose Kamiab in the course of that. You get surrounded by fantastic volunteers whose hearts are in the right place. You get to aspire to do really lofty things, to pass private members' bills or to fight for human rights or to profile the terrible plight of drug dependent people who, in the case of the party I represented, seemed to be kind of off the radar screen when I was there. Happily, that's changed. But at any rate, I've taken your words to heart, Carrie. And even though I would love to run again, I think that there's more important things for me to do at this point in life. So I head a nonprofit called the Canadian Health and Fitness Institute, which seeks to lift the physical, mental, and spiritual health of people. And I think that's really important at a time when our society seems to be ailing and lonely and sedentary and subject to cardio disease and diabetes and mental illness. And so I'm hoping that the people that I will be helping to get elected will work with me in promoting mental, physical, and spiritual health. And I'm hoping our audience will be happy that I'm going to continue with a third season of Things That Matter. I just think tonight's discourse was fantastic. I thank all three of you. I thought a whole lot of you before you came on the show, and I think way more even now after tonight's discussion. So merci bien, sieh, and thank you.
Thank you all. And John, it takes courage to say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something else. So I applaud your courage, and I am confident you're going to do amazing things in that role. There's so much need for what the Institute will bring.
So, well, thank you. Thank you for that.
That's wonderful.
Well, thank you for being great role models on behalf of the audience and myself. I'm going to sign off, and I won't even think about how late it is where you are, Carrie, but it's even getting late here. So
try to go to sleep again.
Carrie and Mamie, okay. It was a true honor chatting with you both. Carrie.
Oh, it was such an honor for me. Really a privilege and so wonderful. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.